it's not easy for everyone to go vegan. It is very difficult for people in certain communities. And this is an injustice that's taking place. And it's an injustice that we should be working on, because it's wrong that healthy food in this country and some places around the world is a privilege instead of a right.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. Today's conversation is with Lauren Ornelas. Lauren is the founder and the executive director of the Food Empowerment Project, a nonprofit food justice organization that spotlights the abuse of animals on farms, unfair working conditions for produce workers, and the unavailability of healthy foods in communities of color and low-income areas. Lauren and I spoke earlier in the pandemic. She had just written a piece on Medium called We Are All Connected, and I read it and it blew me away. It was written back in April, but could not be more relevant now with the demonstrations in our streets calling out systemic racism. I'm going to read you a paragraph from the piece. As many of us know, COVID-19 has just proven what we know, that racism and inequalities that exist for Black, Indigenous, and Brown people in this country are a barrier to success and living healthy lives. Our communities have been losing lives due to police violence, lack of health care, lack of healthy food, lack of clean drinking water, environmental racism, lack of living wages, and the list goes on. However, what makes COVID-19 even more dangerous is that these problems still exist and in some ways are exacerbated. And later she says, "But I am more determined than ever that we must truly fight the systems that have a role in how we got here." And that is exactly what Lauren and the Food Empowerment Project are doing.
So for you personally, since you went vegan in the 80s and you were in Texas, correct?
Yes.
That couldn't have been easy. How you were high school?
I was in high school, yeah.
And how was that, going vegan in Texas in the 80s?
It was not easy, as you would imagine. I mean, I was lucky enough to have a local animal rights group in the community. What I didn't realize till much later is that the heads of the group weren't vegan. So I've actually been vegan longer than them, but that I had them. And, but in terms of just real world, like being in high school and, you know, being called a hippie because I had long purple hair, but I wore padlocks and boots, you know, I felt like I was more of a punk rocker than a hippie, but you know, in Texas, I don't think they could quite tell the difference. It was very hard being in school. I had teachers who, when I wouldn't dissect, called me a baby in class and ridiculed me. Just being out in the world, you know how it is when you first go vegan, it's you're like, oh my God, once everybody knows, they're going to change. And you know, here I am in Texas where you got rodeos going on and barbecues everywhere. And you know, it was very difficult. I think that for the longest time, my mom thought it was a fad that I was going through. And she was very patient when I was vegetarian, but by the time I went vegan, I think she was like, you know, I'm done. But she still wanted me to find cruelty-free makeup and non-leather boots. But it wasn't easy, but it was not anything I ever thought, I can't do this. I always felt very proud of doing it. And, you know, being a rebellious teenager, that was like the best thing, to be different than everybody and being like, no, I'm not going to harm any animals.
You were an activist right away too.
Yes, I started the first animal rights group in a high school in Texas. It was called, what was that? Youth for Animals. Yeah, so we were just getting started at the high school, and I was involved in the local animal rights group and going to anti-fur protests and all that kind of stuff from the time I was 17, actually.
Which led to a very big career in animal rights and activism. For a long time, that was your main focus. When did it sort of evolve into, hey, this is about the animals, but it's also about the humans and the planet? Because you've really just melded all of these things into one, like I said, something that makes so much sense, but so few people are doing.
Right.
How did that all happen?
Thank you for that. Well, when I was young, my mom always raised me with the knowledge of the Great Boycott. I mean, as a proud Chicana, my mom was, you know, I should say I'm a proud Chicana, but my mom always raised us with it, my sisters and I, with an understanding of the Great Boycott and what it meant for farm workers. So I was boycotting grapes at a very early age and had my own experience with not being able to stick with being vegetarian because my family had to eat what people gave us. You know, we didn't have a lot of money. My mom raised us by herself. And so I wanted to be vegetarian, but when people brought us food, I had no choice but to eat what they brought us. So I understood what that was like as well. By the time I was in high school, I was familiar with the anti-apartheid movement and that the part of what they were asking people to do in the United States was to boycott products that were still vested in apartheid in South Africa, which included a boycott of Coca-Cola. So I already had in my life and in my being an understanding of other human rights issues. I was very involved when I was in high school and in college on human rights issues. But my main passion was devoted to animal rights because I felt like it was something I could do all the time and I could do myself. And so when I was running an organization called Viva USA, it was based in England and I ran the USA chapter. And I did investigations of factory farms and slaughterhouses. My boss was very understanding when a boycott was going to be potentially called against strawberries for farm workers. And I was like, can I please include this in our materials? And she was absolutely supportive of that. Then in 2000, I learned about what was happening in Western Africa for chocolate. And I realized I could never look at chocolate the same way again. And so in doing interviews for my investigations or corporate campaigns for non-human animals, I would often bring up what was happening to farm workers, or I would bring up what was happening in the chocolate industry. And I started getting complaints by animal rights activists who were saying that I was hurting the animals, that I shouldn't take time away from talking about the animals by talking about these other human rights issues. So in 2006, I went and spoke at the World Social Forum in Caracas, Venezuela, and I was speaking about corporate animal agriculture and how it hurt workers and the environment and the animals. And when I was there, I was, you know, I was invigorated learning about the privatization of water fights in Bolivia, immigration issues, worker issues. And I just realized that I could no longer silo my activism to just non-human animals, that I needed to create an organization on my own where I could combine all of these issues together. And that's why I started Food Empowerment Project, that it wasn't an this or that, it was, this is all important, let's work on this all together. And it really combined my passion for issues on, you know, corporate greed, immigration issues, worker issues, environmental issues, and of course, non-human animals.
For people who've never heard of Food Empowerment Project, because it's so multifaceted and makes so much sense, but it's also so unusual. And the fact that it's unusual really needs to change. So can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. Food Empowerment Project's basic goal is to help show people how our food is connected, really how the whole world is connected, but we've kind of spotlighted how we're all connected. And also to show that there are a lot of injustices in our food supply. And we want to help inform people as to what's going on, but we also want to help create tools to help people eat their ethics. So our work is basically broken down into four areas. One is veganism, because, you know, for those people who have access to healthy foods, we don't want anybody contributing to the suffering of non-human animals. And so we are a very proud ethically vegan organization. We have campaigns that we run on veganism. We also have a couple of websites, Vegan Mexican Food, which is in English and Spanish, Vegan Tagalog Food in English and Tagalog, and we're working on vegan Lao food right now. But, you know, also to draw in for those of us who are a part of the organization to brag about and share our ethnic roots and how delicious our vegan foods can be. We also, because we're a vegan organization and essentially we're encouraging people to eat more produce, we do not want to ignore the plight of farm workers, that we recognize that by ourselves eating produce and encouraging more people to eat more produce, we have an obligation to advocate for the rights of farm workers as well. So we do this by supporting boycotts and campaigns led by farm worker organizations. We work on regulatory and legislative changes. And every year we also do a school supply drive for the children of farm workers to thank them to give back to them for all that they do for feeding us. We also work to try and get people not to eat chocolate sourced from the worst forms of child labor, including slavery. We've created a list to help people buy chocolate. It's on our website. And the last part of our work is lack of access to healthy foods in Black and Brown communities. Now, Indigenous communities also lack access to healthy foods, but we aren't currently working in those areas. Our work is predominantly in Black and Brown communities. What we're doing here is we do assessments of communities. We do focus groups. We also currently are working to get a worker-owned cooperative in one of the communities we work with. And again, we do this type of work because a lot of times vegan organizations go into these communities or they say for everyone to go vegan, when in fact, it's not easy for everyone to go vegan. It is very difficult for people in certain communities. And this is an injustice that's taking place. And it's an injustice that we should be working on because it's wrong that healthy food in this country and some places around the world is a privilege instead of a right. But also because if we want people to be able to eat healthier for them and or even for non-human animals, they have to be able to access that healthy food. And so we want to make sure that they get it.
I want to talk about the pandemic and what's happening right now with COVID-19. I read your piece in Medium and I thought it was incredible.
I think that when we look at what's happening right now with COVID-19, I think what we're seeing is just like the Band-Aid's been ripped off to some extent to look at all the inequities and injustices that we already knew were taking place in our country and in the world. I think that looking at, say, farm workers is a perfect example of this. Farm workers in our country are not reaping the benefits that other workers reap, from paid sick time to vacations, unemployment, but going to even more basic necessities such as taking bathroom breaks, taking lunch breaks, and not having to worry about them losing money when they are going to the restroom or taking a lunch break, because a lot of them get paid by how much they pick. So even basic things that a lot of workers just accept as, you know, part of the law, our farm workers don't get. Many are homeless. Many are living, you know, 16 to a one bedroom. So these problems already existed. They are threatened with deportation if they try to speak up. Some of them are living in what we call environmental racism areas, where at least one of the labor camps that we know of in California is located in between a dump and a correctional facility. So you have people who I would say their immune system is already incredibly low. They are dealing with stress. They're dealing with living, you know, with negative pollutants in their communities. A lot of them are food insecure, so they aren't eating healthy. So you have this already existing in the lives of farm workers who feed all of us. Unless you pick your own food, you have a farm worker to thank. So we have structural racism and other inequities going on. And then you add in COVID-19. So a lot of the things that many of us are very privileged to do, such as washing our hands several times a day, many of them don't have running water. They are traveling together because a lot of them don't have cars. So they're all piling in cars together or they're taking public transportation. So they don't have the ability to distance themselves 6 feet. They don't have that ability to do that when they're in the fields working either. So you have a lot of these problems that are just made worse by this. And yet we are deeming them essential workers. And these are essential workers who are not reaping any of the benefits that some other essential workers might, such as paid healthcare, paid sick time. And worse, these are also essential workers, much like our fast food workers and the grocery store workers, who don't even make a lot of money to begin with.
So let's start with the going vegan and how many vegans say, hey, it's so easy to go vegan, and how not true that is in so many of the communities that you're in. Will you talk about that a little bit and how difficult it actually is?
I think that we say it's easy to go vegan. And again, I've been vegan since 1988. So I've been vegan for a long time. And I know that there's that reaction to be like, okay, we don't want people to put barriers up to go vegan because it's better for the animals. And so we say things like that. But it's not true. And we sound ignorant when we say that. What we do is we survey communities for access to healthy foods. So that includes fresh, canned, frozen produce, as well as meat and dairy alternatives. And, you know, what's available in a lot of these communities and in the communities that we work in, a lot of them are getting their food from liquor stores and convenience stores. There are no grocery stores in their communities. So what they may have is absolutely no produce, or they might have a few produce. They may have a couple of potatoes or onions, and sometimes this food is rotten, it's moldy. So it's not really healthy food. Meat and dairy alternatives are almost non-existent. Organics almost non-existent. So it's really hard to hear when vegans say that, because anybody in that room who has a family member or a friend who lives in one of these communities knows that that's simply not true.
Right.
And it kind of negates everything else that they've said. And so that's why we try to just say, look, at least say for those who have access to healthy foods or something simple, to not at least make it seem like it's easy for everybody when it's not. The fact is that some communities absolutely don't have that right. Everybody should have the right to eat their ethics, and everybody should have a right to be healthy and thrive. And that's just not the case right now.
And talk about a little bit about the actual changing it, and what FEP is doing and what the country needs to be doing in terms of making healthy food more accessible.
One of the problems that's happened is that well-intentioned NGOs or government officials come in and they tell communities what they need instead of listening to what the community wants or what their actual barriers are. So they'll put up things like a farmer's market without checking with the community on what's the best day, when we'll work for this community, you know, really finding out what works best for them. Other times, you know, we've seen corporations being turned to and putting things like Walmart in communities. And poverty follows Walmart. You know, they're not even paying their workers well. So to expect that to help a community is not going to happen. So we've done focus groups with communities that we work in to find out what they want, what their barriers are. And we've even done things like if the food was grown in, like, let's use the community of Vallejo, California, which is where we're doing our work in right now. If this was grown by Vallejo People's Garden, would you be more inclined to buy it? Absolutely. Are you interested in growing your home food? Absolutely. So people are interested in growing their own foods, but because we know that, including myself, I've only ever rented. I don't know what it's like to own property, not that I'm sure I would ever want to. But, you know, a lot of people don't have that privilege of growing their own food. And so what else is there? And so we did introduce in our focus groups the idea of a worker-owned cooperative. And only one person in the 7 focus groups that we did had ever heard of that. And the reason why we find worker-owned cooperatives to be part of the solution is because workers own the grocery store. Workers make the profits, they make the decisions on the profits, they live in the community, and what their goal is to look out for that community. So worker-owned cooperatives is another way that we see as part of the solution to help bring money to that community, creating entrepreneurial skills for the people who live there. So those are two of the ways that we see a solution to all of this. And money and funding should be given to those groups on the ground who are doing this work. We do our reports and we give them to the community groups for free. And we tell them, give this to your funders, show them why your work is necessary and important for you to get the money. We give our data to the cities, the counties, and the universities so they can use the data that we've collected to help see why they need more funding in those areas in their community.
Are you seeing change?
In our work in Santa Clara County, you know, we focused on San Jose because that was one of the most impacted areas. And when we did our focus groups with the community groups, they started to see like how much their community wanted to be able to grow their own food. So we have seen an increase in that.
Will you go back for a second and talk about the chocolate and then and now what's happening with chocolate and slavery?
Yes. When I learned about it, I watched a documentary from England about what was happening in the chocolate industry. And they had asked a former slave, what would you say to Westerners who still eat chocolate? And the former slave said, tell them when they eat chocolate, they're eating my flesh. And I thought, that is the same thing as a non-human animal would say. And there's no way I can look at chocolate the same way again. And so it was something from then on that I didn't eat any chocolate. When I started Food Empowerment Project and I started talking about the chocolate issue, a lot of people would ask me, what kind of chocolate can I eat? And so it required us to do more investigation on if there was good chocolate out there. So why is chocolate problematic to begin with? Well, in Western Africa and in Brazil, child labor and slavery is going on for chocolate. We have children ages 6, 7 to adulthood who are involved in the chocolate industry. And these individuals get there from a variety of ways. Sometimes their families think they're going to get it. This is a job. They're going to go and they're going to work and they're going to be able to send money back. And the parents never see their children again. Some are sold into it. They're very poor community. So maybe an uncle or an aunt might sell the child into the chocolate industry. Or worse, they're stolen from marketplaces. And these children are trafficked hundreds of miles from home where their local dialect is not even spoken where they're working. The kids are having to lift bags of cacao that are about 40 pounds. If they don't move fast enough, they're beaten. A lot of time, these children are locked in overnight. And if they try to escape, they're beaten. 2016, I think it was, might have been more recent than that. But slaves were liberated ages 6 to 16 years old. 2017, children were being sold for about, you know, less than $30 each to work in the chocolate industry. So, you know, we have children who are, you know, dealing with dangerous tools such as machetes. They're dealing with agricultural chemicals that are poisoning them, all for the chocolate industry. So we created this list to help people buy chocolate that isn't sourced from areas where the worst forms of child labor and slavery are the most prevalent, to help people not participate. But more importantly, we want people to, you know, obviously not buy these products, but just equally important is letting the companies know why. The companies have to know why and know that people care and don't want other human beings treated this way.
And so when you were at this conference and you kind of had this moment of, wait a minute, I want to be fighting for animals, for humans, against slavery, did you come back and just start? How did like the world react to this when you first, when you kind of came out as, hey, it's not just about the animals anymore?
You know, it was hard. I got a lot of jokes and pushback about, honestly, the exact same thing a vegan faces with people who consume animals, I faced with people eating chocolate, vegans eating chocolate, saying, oh, this slavery tastes so good in this chocolate. You know, I dealt with things like that. I dealt with my work being marginalized. I dealt with my voice being silenced. I dealt with that a lot. I dealt with, and we still deal with it, you know, in the sense that, you know, we'll be tabling at a veg fest and we'll be told, what does this have to do with veganism? Or what does this have to do with the animal rights? And it's like disheartening. We had a chapter in Washington State for a couple of years, and they weren't allowed to table at a veg fest because they were told that our work wasn't relevant to veganism. So it's something that we dealt with, and it's something we continue to deal with. We have people who write us when we do donation requests who say, we bet those slaves eat chickens.
I mean, I'm speechless. Yeah. Animal rights and human rights are very much connected. And I think in order to fight for one or the other, there does need to be this element of fighting for both.
Absolutely.
What I don't understand is why, especially now when we know so much and the world is so much more connected and global, that it hasn't become a bigger thing, that it both are incorporated together in a lot of these groups.
Yeah, and I think that you see that very well by our funding. We've been around since 2007. We didn't get funding for me to work on FEP full-time until 2013, and that was with one of our donors saying she'd pay me $1,000 a month, and my husband and I moving to a place that wasn't really great just so I could get FEP on the ground. There are organizations that just focus on farmed animals, and they are much larger than we are, because we don't get the same amount of funding. Luckily, what's changing it, I believe, and my hope is, like people always ask you, what's give you hope? It's that young people right now don't need me to hold their hand through why it's important. They get it. They seem to understand that this is all connected. Whereas a lot of people my age, some a bit younger, some a bit older, still don't get that. But the young people really are like, well, duh, of course it's all connected. You know, it's it's the most refreshing thing ever to be like, yeah, no, I don't need you to explain this to me when I'm used to like having to take like, you know, 20 minutes at our table to explain why it's important to people.
No, that's very exciting. And they're a lot smarter than they are. I mean, they've been exposed to so much more, and they've grown up with so much more information and a lot more good being thrown in their faces than I think we ever had. Talk to me about what people can do right now as for you guys, but also for farm workers, and how people can get behind them and learn what to boycott. It's complicated because vegans already are like, well, I eat this, I don't eat that. But it's more layered in terms of what you really should be eating and shouldn't be eating in terms of whose life is being devastated by your food choices. So will you talk a little about that and how people can get more informed and be more helpful?
I always think vegans are in the best place to be doing some of this work because we already are so thoughtful about what we eat. We read labels, we read companies. And so we seem like we're in the perfect position to already get why eating your ethics is so important. But what people have always needed to do is to honor the boycotts called by farm workers themselves. And, you know, right now the Coalition of Immokalee Workers are asking for boycotts of Wendy's. Who cares if they have a vegan burger? We're boycotting them. And you tell them why. They're asking people to boycott Publix as well.
Will you tell why with both of those?
Sure. Because they're asking for 1 penny more per pound of tomatoes that they pick. And these two companies won't give it to them. They're asking for them to be part of their fair wage campaign. That's just asking for them to be paid and treated with dignity. The San Quintin farm workers in Mexico are asking people to boycott Driscoll's berries because they are not treating the workers with dignity. They're suffering from wage theft and other problems that are taking place. So those are the two campaigns that we know of right now that farm workers are asking us to boycott. And when you go to the grocery store and you see Driscoll's berries, we encourage you just to ask that grocery store to try to source berries from other locations because there is a boycott against Driscoll's. One of the things that we feel that you can do for farm workers and really all workers, especially low-wage workers who tend to be Black and brown and single mothers and women, is to help, you know, right now the spotlight is on these workers, right? Because many of them all of a sudden, grocery store workers, fast food workers are all of a sudden being deemed essential workers like farm workers. So what we need to do is not let this moment pass. We need to make sure that we look at the structural and racist systems that are in place that are preventing these people from being able to achieve their own goals. We need to make sure we sign any petitions, speak it out to any policymakers about the need for them to be paid living wages, that they be paid sick leave, that they've been getting the same treatment as any other essential workers by having paid childcare. We need to make sure that we don't let this moment pass and that we speak up for all these workers so that even after, if there is a really after COVID-19, when things go to whatever the new normal is going to be, that they have their rights.
That's awesome, Lauren. And what about FEP? How can people get behind you guys?
Well, I mean, obviously donations are great, but I think that going, you know, we sign up to our e-newsletter, follow us on social media, amplify our voices. One of the reasons why people think that our movement is very white is because we don't amplify the voices of those of us, Black and brown activists and organizations that are out there. And so I think, you know, spreading the word about our work goes a long way.
Awesome. Lauren, thank you so much.
Thank you. And thanks for having us. And I really, it means so much to hear that people understand and appreciate our work more than you know. That just really helps Wednesday.
It's incredible.
Thank you very much.
To learn more and support the Food Empowerment Project, go to foodispower.org. We'll also have links to Lauren and all of her work at our website, speciesunite.com. We're on Facebook and Instagram at speciesunite. And if you have a spare minute and could do us a favor, please rate and review the podcast wherever you listen. It really helps people find the show. And if you'd like to support the podcast, we would greatly appreciate it. We're on Patreon at patreon.com/speciesunite. I would like to thank everybody at Species Unite, including Gary Knutson, Natalie Martin, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, and Anna Kollner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thanks so much for listening, and have a wonderful day.